What I wanted to say today, mainly to begin, perhaps this is somewhat carrying preaching to the converted or carrying coals to Newcastle, but I want to have a little beginning before I talk about Buddhism and the media to talk about Buddhism itself. And to do that, I just want to review a little bit the discovery of what Buddha is, what Buddha discovered, from the way I understand it anyway, and how that relates to the issue of media and communication. As I was listening to Hertian speak, I was thought of a Zen story, because Hertian reminds me of a Zen person very much. I was thinking of a famous Zen story which is in the Blue Cliff Record, which I, of course, only know in English, but where a Zen master says, from birth to death, the Buddha never said a single word, maintained silence. And the Zen master then commented upon that, which you sometimes hear people say things like that. Nagarjuna once said that. And the Zen master commented, such a garrulous non-speaking. His lack of speech filled the Dragon King's cave with tons of books and scriptures and sutras and shastras. So it was a very garrulous non-speaking, a very talkative non-speaking. And this sort of paradox of an enlightenment experience, an awareness of the nature of reality that somehow is inexpressible in words, is beyond any kind of articulation, and yet the Buddhists constantly talk. They have talked for thousands of years. They write a tremendous amount of books. In Tibet, we had like thousands of huge monasteries and libraries filled with texts. And as a translator, which is what I consider my primary work to be, I have only, after 45 years of work, I have only done a dozen or so works, and there are 3,800 in the particular collection, remaining to be done in the particular collection I'm concerned with, what's known as the Tendur. So Buddhism was involved with media in the beginning, from the beginning. And even there is an idea that the Buddhist silence, the silence of a Buddha, or of an enlightened being, itself is a form of communication. In other words, silence by itself also is not expressing the nature of ultimate reality. Even ultimate reality or actual reality, that means to say, is beyond silence as well as speech, in fact. And silence itself is only a kind of punctuation of speech or a type of speech, a kind of opening of the doorway for everyone else to gain a certain type of experience. So Buddhism and media should not be considered too much of a contradiction, is what I wanted originally to say. Now, second point, or related to that, is the point of Buddhism as a religion. Now, I'm aware, and I think it's wonderful, by the way, in Holland, I've been learning from Babette and from Hertian and others, and George, about how in Holland there is this wonderful thing by the government where the different religious movements in the country have a voice in the public domain through broadcasting. And this is supported by the government and is not a commercial activity. And this is really wonderful. In America, of course, we do have a public television, but they certainly don't think they have a duty to show, to expose the voices of the different religious movements. And therefore, what we have are commercial Christian stations, which are very powerful and have raised huge sums of money with which they are putting to the use of trying to undermine the secularism of America and to dominate the political discourse and so on. And so it would be wonderful if there were public support for the different religious movements, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Taoism, whatever, to have a voice. It would be really, really marvelous. And so it's something that is very much to be treasured. And it is a fact, of course, that Buddhism is thought of as a world religion. However, we have to think, in thinking about that, it isn't really like other religions, Buddhism. It has some distinctive element about it. Why? The way we define religion in religious studies, modern religious studies today, is primarily as a belief system. And so people are considered to be a member of a religion when they believe certain things. And indeed, the expression of that credo or belief is paramount. And then the religions also compete with each other and seek to convert each other, other people, to adopt their belief system. Buddha was different in the sense that when Buddha went out to try to discover the nature of reality, to find out the solution to suffering, which was his concern, he did actually meet the gods. People often say Buddhism is non-theistic, but that isn't really true because the Buddhists do not question the existence of the gods. And even the creator god of India at that time was known as Brahma, Brahma was someone who talked with Buddha. They had seminars and dialogues together. And the Buddhists never said Brahma doesn't exist. But they did say, or rather in the Buddhist literature, Brahma himself says, when he's asked by Buddha and by other monks who have that ability to go to the Brahma heaven, and they ask Brahma, the creator, you're the creator, they say, how does the world work? What is the world? What is the reality of the world? What is the meaning of life? You created it, you should know. And Brahma, after some hemming and hawing, actually always says, actually, I don't know because I didn't create it. And actually, I'm glad to tell you that because I would like the human beings to know that I didn't create it, because I would like the human beings to know that when things are really horrible for them, it's not my fault. I didn't do it. It's their own karma, it's their own action, their own mistake, and we're working on it together. I'd like to help them as much as I can, but I'm not in control of everything 100%. So this is a wonderful, slightly lighthearted, but I think very sincere approach in the Buddhist literature. So the Buddhists are theistic, but they relativize the divine. They make it relational to human beings. They do not presume some sort of absolute monotheistic entity that controls everything. And so that's an important point. But the point is that Buddha did not receive a commission from a deity to go out and tell people that if they believe in that deity, then that deity will save them from suffering, which is the majority of the world religions. This is the message that the different prophets say. They have different names for the deities, Shiva or Allah or Yahweh or whatever it may be, a Vishnu. But it's basically the deity will take care of you if you believe in that deity and call upon that deity to do so. Whereas the Buddha said, no deity can take care of you. Even I, Buddha, can't take care of you. I'm sad to say you have to take care of yourself. But I'm happy to say that you will be able to take care of yourself if you develop your understanding, your prajna, your wisdom. And that's up to you to develop an understanding of the world. And the second encouraging thing the Buddha said to us, since we feel very unable to understand the world often, we are told by our cultures that we cannot understand. But the Buddha said, yes, you can. A human being does have the ability to understand herself or himself and the world completely. That's what I am, Buddha said. I was a human being, Siddhartha, and I was running around being a prince, and then I was being an ascetic. And now I have decided to try to understand the world, and I find that I can, and I have understood it. I am now a Buddha, some being who understands the world. But I don't even ask you to believe that, Buddha said. In fact, I want you to doubt that I understand. I want you to question that I understand. I don't want you to accept what I say on the basis of authority, just to say, oh, I obey what you say. I think what you say, Buddha. Buddha didn't want that. He said, that won't do you. But why? That won't do you any good. Because believing somebody else understands does not necessarily make you understand. And the point is, therefore, Buddhism from the beginning, because of that view, that the world is such that that beings who suffer can only solve their suffering and escape from their suffering by understanding it and understanding its causes and understanding how to change those causes into the causes of freedom from suffering. Because of that view, and no one else can just arbitrarily or mechanically save us from suffering, the Buddha was forced to be an educator primarily. He was forced to seek to bring out of us the wisdom that lies within us, overcovered and overlaid by a layer of confusion and delusion and doubt and egotism and mistaken view. Right? So I think you probably all know that. You're all Buddhists. You probably should know that. There are kinds of Buddhists maybe who think I can just believe in Buddha and he'll save me. But even Amitabha, even Pure Land Buddhists, who are into, because the movement grew up in India originally and then in East Asia in agricultural societies and was particularly popular amongst those who are not so well educated and was a devotion and a faith-oriented thing. But what people don't notice if they think that Amitabha is going to save them from suffering is that Amitabha's Pure Land is not Nirvana. When you get to the Pure Land, you're like in a lotus and it's really nice and it's heaven and you're sitting there, and then what is happening is you're a captive audience, you're stuck in that lotus, and Amitabha is teaching all the time, and you have to study 24 hours a day until you understand. Even you don't get to lounge in heaven. Heaven becomes like a classroom. Of course, it's nice, you're in a jewel lotus, and the duck goes by, and the jewel duck goes by, and the jewel duck goes quack. But instead of quack, it says, all compounded things are suffering. It says, the cause of suffering is ignorance. It says, the freedom from suffering is nirvana. That's what the quack says. Even the water, when it trickles, the impermanence, freedom, all of these things emerge, selflessness, these teachings emerge from the trickling of the water in the Pure Land. So it's a pedagogue's dreamland, really, rather than some sort of paradise. The Buddhist Pure Land. So this is the name, you all know this, and I might illustrate it a little further, because I think it's fun, and we don't normally think of it like that, about the Four Noble Truths. And there may be a few of you who are not Buddhists, and it's always a challenge to me that everyone should know what Buddhism is. And this is what it is. The Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths. And the first Noble Truth has been terribly misunderstood because he said that all unenlightened beings are suffering, inevitably. But people misunderstood that, for example, the previous Pope, as meaning that everyone has to suffer inevitably forever. But that was not Buddha's idea at all. In fact, that's not a discovery. Everybody knows that. We all know we're miserable and suffering. We are miserable. Well, actually, in Amsterdam, I think you're less miserable than those of us who live in New Amsterdam, that is to say, New York. In America, we're much more miserable nowadays than you are. I think with your canals and your boats, I think you're really quite cheerful, relatively speaking. But still, you're suffering unless you're enlightened, is what Buddha said. And he only said that because he saw that we human beings had the ability to become enlightened and thereby become free of suffering, which is an utterly preposterous claim, actually, if you think about it. Whoever told you that you could live completely happily without any suffering whatsoever? Nobody tells you that. Well, they might say, well, yes, in heaven later, God will do it, or somewhere when you meet Beatrice with Dante in heaven and sing hymns all the time, you can be free of suffering because you don't have a body anymore. But nobody says, even Freud doesn't say he can solve your suffering. Freud said he will help you with your neurotic suffering so you can get back to regular, good old daily suffering. That's what he said. So Buddha made the claim that we can be completely free of suffering if we get rid of the cause of suffering. And what is the cause of suffering? It's very simple. It's delusion and ignorance. And what is that? What is that? Everyone wonders, what is that? But I always like to illustrate, when I have a captive audience, I always like to illustrate it. What is ignorance? Ignorance is wrong translation, really. Misknowledge is a proper translation. Delusion is okay. Misknowledge is like a misunderstanding, because that is something that you think you know. And what do we, each of us, think we know here today, except those of you who are enlightened, and those of you, I beg your pardon, in case you're enlightened. Otherwise, the rest of us, each of us thinks, I'm me. Right? Babette thinks she's Babette. I think I'm Bob. Hertian thinks he is Hertian. Everyone else thinks they are themselves, right? You think so. You know you are, actually. You have an ID card, probably, from the Dutch government. You have a driver's license. You have your identification card, and you know who you are. Furthermore, you know that you're not me, for sure. And you're not the person sitting next to you. You know that, too. And you're just the person inside your own skin. Correct? Am I right? You know that. If you suddenly didn't know which person in here you were, you would wonder what you had drunk or where you had been. Now, that knowledge that you have then makes you a little bit uneasy. Why? Because you're you, and that makes you the main person here, as far as you're concerned. You're sort of the center of the event here. Am I right? Each of you. And you may not be in the central seat. Martin is in the central seat with his microphone. So he knows he's the main person. He has his microphone on, I mean, his earphone on. But you feel you are, and then you suddenly know one other thing, which is what? Nobody else thinks you're the main person here. On top of that, each of them thinks they're the main person here. So each person here is the center of the room and the main person here. And yet nobody agrees with anybody. And we're fine, we're happy, we're having a talk, we're comfortable sitting down, it's nice climate, it's Holland, it's Amsterdam. If the place was burning, if we were starving, if this was Baghdad, we would see the result of that fact that each person is there just themselves. And in a way, they're in an ontological cosmic situation of oneself against the universe, everyone else. Temporarily, you know, few people agree with you that you're the main person. Your mother agreed with you for a short time. Your lover agrees with you for a shorter time, probably. And occasionally some people agree with you. But even you become, you know, like Prime Minister of Holland, they won't agree with you for long, even after they vote. So therefore, you're in a position, we're in a position where as long as we think we're it, we're in a position of struggling with the universe. And in that struggle, we definitely lose. It's a sort of common sense, isn't it? And that is the Buddha's discovery. Now, if that was all it was, Buddha would never have said a word. He wouldn't have given any teaching, wouldn't have used the media. Because if it was an inevitable situation, you're always going to feel like that. You'll always be against the universe. It will come at you with sickness, death, old age, loss of friends, meeting of enemies. It will just be a terrible time the whole time. Occasionally, you'll have a little safe space by your canal there, you know, have a nice dinner. But mostly, it's bad. And if that were inevitable, for Buddha to start teaching all the universe, all unenlightened life is suffering, as the Dalai Lama likes to say, it would be like someone going to a person who has life imprisonment and going, nyah, nyah, you're stuck. There's nothing you can do about it. The only reason he said it is because what he discovered was we can become free of that situation. And the way we become free is that we develop the understanding that our feeling of ourself as separate and absolutely different from the world is a mistake. We're not really that different. We're not really ourselves. We are ourselves, but not really ourselves. We're relationally ourselves. We're interconnected with other beings. Your success is not my loss, necessarily. You know, your life is not, my life doesn't need to somehow get rid of your life to be there. Our lives enrich each other. They're interconnected with each other. This difference is a huge difference. It seems unlikely that it should be. But from the Buddha's point of view, when you understand that your difference from the universe is only relational, it doesn't mean that you don't exist. Buddhism is often misunderstood as that. The big thing is, eureka, I don't exist. But I'm telling you, an Indian audience in ancient time, if Buddha had jumped up and said, eureka, I don't exist, therefore I'm a Buddha, everyone would say, if you don't exist, shut up and go home and leave us alone. Why do we need a non-existent person talking to us? So Buddha never said that. He said, I don't exist the way I thought I existed, as separate from you. I'm absolutely separate from you. I exist relationally. We have our differences. We interconnect. We have been interconnected in previous life. We've always been around. We will always will be around. We have all kind of interconnection. But I'm not absolutely different. We're all in one continuum of life. And therefore, we're not in a conflict with each other, actually, ultimately. And being harmoniously together with each other rather than in conflict with each other is nirvana, basically, finally. We wrongly think of nirvana as some place outside the world. And there is a teaching of Buddha like that sounds like that. Sometimes he talks like that to some people who cannot imagine being really happy and still being in this room. They think they ought to be really happy, they'd have to be on the beach in Spain. No, they think to be really happy, they'd have to be in some sort of otherworldly nirvana or heaven or some other place. So when people cannot imagine that, he will let them think that nirvana is somewhere else. But ultimately, they discover nirvana is here for anyone who understands what the reality of this here is, really. What is this here, really? The real reality of it, you know, and the quantum level, let's say, below every other level, you know. Below the atomic level, in the level of pure energy and pure mind, what is the reality here? The reality here is nirvana, is what the Buddha's discovery was. So then the Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth, was the method of how we get rid of the misunderstanding and how we develop the understanding. And in order to do that, education is primary. The three, what are called the three higher educations, which is Buddhism in practice, in all the traditions of Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, all the versions of Theravada and Mahayana, even Vajrayana, in every tradition of Buddhism, there are these three educations, the ethical education, the mental or psychological or meditational education, and the wisdom education, which means understanding. It doesn't mean some sort of resignation. It means a penetrating understanding of the nature of the world. Now, so therefore, for example, nowadays when people ask me in audiences in America or anywhere wherever I talk, what really is Buddhism? I always say Buddhism is engaged realism, basically. Because Buddha's insight was that reality itself is freedom from suffering, is nirvana. Of the Four Noble Truths, only the third is true reality. The first, second, and fourth are actually slightly deceptive reality. They're what's called relative reality, or false reality, or misleading reality. They're not unreal, they're not non-existent, but they're like a movie, like a television show. They're a little bit delusory, they're deceptive. They look like something that they are not. Whereas the nirvana is the one that is the reliable actual reality of things. That means the actual, not just ultimate, it's something elsewhere. Actual reality of here. Now, in that light, therefore, the journalist, now I come back to media. Okay, have I made those points? Is that clear? I mean, I don't know if you agree, but you don't have to, but we can discuss it. But that's a very important point, because otherwise people think that religions are sort of pie in the sky. You know, they can't face reality, so they make up something that there's another one somewhere that is really great, and then they believe in that and they want to get there, and it often results, unfortunately, in treating this reality badly when people become fanatical. And then they are nasty to this reality because they feel they can commit suicide in the name of religion because they think that they're going to the better reality that way. They're leaving this unpleasant reality. And often that's the case. And even Buddhism can be used that way in thinking, well, if I just die for Buddha, then I'll get to nirvana. Luckily, that's fairly rare because Buddha sort of said, don't die for me. You're going to die for yourself anyway. Don't pretend you're dying for me. And that won't help you. In fact, and your human life is too precious to throw away without using it to develop your understanding. So it's very rare in Buddhism. Buddhists are human, and they'd like to go in some crusade and have a big charge and do this and that. But it's very, very disillusioning when you're on your Buddhist horse and you have your sword and you're ready to charge and you go, for emptiness! Which way do I go? You kind of lose your momentum. You can't say for daddy or mommy, you know, the way that the personalized, monotheistic religions do. So it's a little harder. But human beings manage, like in Sri Lanka and a few places, they manage still to be nasty in the name of Buddhism. So the point is, then, coming back to, if we have those points, that the Buddha discovered that reality is perfect, and then is nirvana, and then he was in this odd situation. Imagine you had that kind of experience. You suddenly saw everyone as completely beautiful. You saw their bodies as made of glowing globules of bliss. And they were all like, in their cells, bliss was what was holding their cells together. And bliss is like the quantum soup is really bliss. And you saw it, and you felt that way yourself. And therefore Buddha's, big smile. Because he's like, he's grooving, as we say in the musical world. Buddha is grooving. And he sees other beings as grooving in their cells. But then he looks at their faces, and he sees all worry and anxiety, and they're feeling very deprived, and they're feeling isolated, and the world is against them. And then because he's Buddha, he feels what they feel, like a CAT scan or a cloud. He's not like stuck in his skin. So suddenly he feels us feeling frightened and anxious, and what is really reality? Maybe we'll fall into hell if we're not careful, or we'll be grabbed by George Bush or by Bin Laden or by some horrible person, and some terrible thing will happen, and we're just going around all worried all the time, if you're just feeling all anxious. And then he feels that, and he sees that's completely unnecessary and based on a mistake. So then his compassion then motivates him and all those who step into his position through that teaching, to try to communicate to the beings their real situation, which is that they are all right, and they don't need to be afraid, and they don't need to be freaked out, and they don't need to hide and to armor and to harm other beings and to do all of these things, right? So when you come back to media, to journalism, to communication, to art, to creativity, then how do you get someone who perceives the world and they think realistically as me versus it, and a very difficult situation that is? How do you get them to see it a different way? Well, the first way you have to do is to get them to imagine such a thing would be possible. Who here can imagine themselves as perfectly happy all the time? And don't tell me, when we meet each other, we say, how are you? We say, I'm fine. I'm great, we say. But that's because we don't think long about it. If anybody hesitates when you ask them, how are you? It's going to be a long, sad story. Because so-and-so died, because my foot hurts, because this and this, So it's hard to even imagine being in such a state. It's not easy that we would really feel good no matter what. And that we would be not disconnected in some sort of euphoria, but we would be connected even to those who don't. And our loved ones, we would try to enfold them within that. And even we would perceive the unloved ones actually are connected. And we would even want to try to enfold them in that. You know, love your enemy. That's how you do love your enemy. When you see that your enemy is only confused and is projecting on you and doesn't even, not even personal. And the only way to stop them from being your enemy is for them to be happy enough that they don't think you're standing in the way of their happiness. And thereby they have no reason to be an enemy of yours. So everyone should wish their enemy happiness, because then their enemy would no longer wish to do them harm. They only want to do you harm because they think you're blocking their, you're obstructing their happiness. It's the only reason, you know. And once they're happy without getting you out of the way, then they're no longer interested in it. You're become boring to them, so they leave you alone. So realism means in art and in journalism and in modern media, it means that you're looking, you know, investigative journalism. You want to know the reality of things. You want to see who did what. What is really true? What is happening there? We are in this amazing position in the modern world where we, you know, like 1,000 years ago, if they were having a genocide in Darfur, a genocide in Tibet, a genocide in Cambodia, or wherever, we would not know. We'd be going along, la, la, singing hymns. We wouldn't have any idea. Today, we know everything. And it's frightening to us, of course, because we're persuaded by the powers that be, that dominate the commercial propaganda media, the corporate media. We're persuaded that we're powerless, meaningless, useless, and nothing that we do has anything will help at all. Now you're listening to an American talk. I know that here in Netherlands, you feel you have control of your government. And I believe you probably do to some extent. You have some real democracy. In America, we have totally lost control of our government. We have no control of them. They pretend to be doing something for us, but actually they serve the corporate paymaster, who give them the money for their election, who give them money for their thing, who then give them the money for their retirement and their study institute so they can go and study about how much damage they did and how great it was and try to pretend they didn't do it. And so that's why everybody is freaked out over there. So we are very freaked out. That's why probably if you open the door, we'd probably all immigrate to Amsterdam if we could. So, not really. We'll stay and fight it out because it's too destructive what emanates from my country nowadays. And I am deeply apologetic. Although we haven't invaded Netherlands yet. But you never know what George Bush on his fourth term, what he'll try to do. So this comes to me. So from the beginning, in India in Buddha's time, you know, the knowledge professionals were the Brahmins. And they were not interested in spreading knowledge. And they were interested in keeping knowledge to remain in control of a hierarchical society. And they considered, and Buddha even was a warrior class, and his colleagues in the warrior class were not interested in him spreading knowledge either, because they were the ones with the political power, the military power. And he was a traitor to his class. And he, however, because of what he saw, that people needed to be educated. They needed to bring out their wisdom, women as well as men, children as well as grown-ups. And then they would be able to enjoy their life, and then they would be able to make a contribution to the society. And he would actually fulfill his duty as a king, originally. There's a little-known discussion between him and his father before he left, where he said to his father, "Listen, Dad, you told me that when I was king, I should protect my subjects from what makes them suffer." "Yes, son, that's right." "Well, what I think makes them suffer is not necessarily having some neighbor who's aggressive, or their economy, or this and that. Those can be difficult, but that's not the main thing. The main thing is sickness, old age, pain, death, loss of loved ones. These are the deeper sufferings that I see they have. And you didn't teach me anything how to help them with that. So therefore, I wouldn't want to be king when I can't really do anything for my people." So that's why he then said, "I want to instead become a Buddha. Then I really will." But then the father said, "Oh, forget it, son. That's what the priests take. The gods take care of that. The priests take care of that." And Buddha said, "They don't do a good enough job. I don't think so." And he was actually rebelled, therefore, against the religion of his time, very much in the tradition of the 60s, 2,500 years ago. And then people later make him into a religion, and it's fine. It's useful, and it can be nice for those who developed a path. But finally, it's a matter of education in Buddhism. And now, what is the great medium of education in the modern world? I go in a classroom and I talk to 100 people, 150 people. I talk to 40, 50 of you here. I talk to, you know, a few thousand sometimes in some places for a few moments. And then they go home, you know. But that's very small exposure. The television there is in the home of people hours a day in America, many, too many hours. They average like 12 hours a day or something. They start with the children because they can't afford to hire a babysitter, so they have to read a story, so they put them on television. You know, they call it the one-eyed nanny, the television in America. And then the grown-ups watch later. And of course, the programs are all product placement. And commercials make you feel dissatisfied and greedy. I need a new car. I need a new clothes. And then the news makes you terrified and frightened. So then I need a bad government. I need a nasty army because I'm so frightened. So the propaganda media we have in America is really ruined now. But imagine if that instrument of the television, if the Dharma was taught on the television, not as in order to convert people to religion, but in order to encourage people to try to understand the world, to show them what was happening, to stimulate their compassion, show them Darfur long enough, show them Tibet long enough, and then this will make, eventually the people will force the leaders to behave. Show them Iraq. The Bush administration, for example, has like blocked the journalism, really. They shoot the journalists practically here and there in Iraq because they don't want people to see. Like they think the lesson of Vietnam is that the people saw the atrocities being committed and the people being killed and the blood and the uselessness of it, and therefore refuse to support it. And they think somehow if they hide that and act like it's all fine, that they can persist in this war, and actually so far they are succeeding. But not really. The people don't want it. But the Congress doesn't serve the people in America anymore. Not at all. None of them, even the supposed liberal. Well, Denis Kucinich is good. There's a few people. And then the media calls them unelectable. But then they have no power. So what it therefore is Buddhist media. Now when Buddhism goes to the media, I have a list actually. What is it that Buddhism wants to communicate to people? And it doesn't, and also Buddha in his own day, he taught what we might call Disney stories. Some of you may have heard of the Jataka tales, what are called Jatakas. And Jatakas are the stories about the Buddha in a former life. And they are the original Walt Disney stories. And actually folklorists, usually Dutch scholars are the only ones who have the patience, sometimes Belgians, usually Jesuits. You know what's called a folklorist. We hardly have it in America because everybody in America is too impatient. But they trace stories like from Aesop Fable, from Scheherazade, 1001 Nights, from Grimm and so forth. And these stories, from the Decameron, Boccaccio. And these go back to the Indian Jataka story. And these are like when the Buddha was a deer. He was the king of the deer, usually. And then he was a good king, and he did this and that. And he saved the doe who was giving birth to, who was pregnant. And he saved her life and so forth by offering his own life in her place. And there's all kind of stories like that, just like Lassie, Old Yellow, you know, the so-and-so, the Jolly Muskrat, or whatever the Disney people used to make. And they used, therefore, entertainment media in the ancient time and told stories and narratives. In a way, the biography of the Buddha itself is kind of an inspiring narrative. The name of the Mahayana version of the Buddha's biography is called Lalita Vistara. And Lalita means a play, actually, Lalita. And it means play like playing a game, and it means play like in a theater. And Vistara means magnificent or expansive or vast. So the Lalita Vistara is the vast play, the vast drama. It's the greatest show on earth, like the circus, you know. That was the Buddha's life story, you know, as told. It is a marvelous story, you know. There are 22 different incidents in the Buddha's story, according to Hajime Nakamura, a Japanese scholar, in the Buddha life story that are very, very similar to events in the Jesus life story. And the Western scholars don't like that much because the Jesus story is, of course, 500 years later. But there are 22 different separate incidents that are almost same, like the way he's born, etc., but with differences too, but very, very similar. And like the Jesus story is a big story that still goes on, you know, day, year after year, every year in the Buddhist countries, the Buddha story goes on. And that's media in ancient Buddhism, you know. And then there's educational media, and then there's all kinds of practical media, and all developing the imagination to see what life can be like and so on. And this is the role of media. But basically, I would label media under two elements of the Eightfold Path. One of them is the first one, which people call, often translate as right view or right worldview, which I don't like to use right. Right and wrong come from a type of ethic where it's a matter of obedience to an omnipotent deity. Right and wrong, you're right or you're wrong, and there's a rule. Whereas Buddhist ethics is more, useful, effective, or not effective, is the way they put it. Kushala, akushala means really skillful or unskillful. You know, wholesome or unwholesome. It's not skillful. It's a bad idea to kill people. Because when you do, then they don't like it. Then they get reborn and they come back and kill you again. You know, this is my prediction that the Bush family will have a grandson who will be born with a little mustache, smoking a cigar. And he will raise hell when he grows up. He'll wreck cars and burn down the family house. Wait and see. You can't get rid of your enemy, the Buddhists don't think, by killing them. Because that doesn't remove them from the world. It removes them from that body, and they subliminally remember that you did it, and they're reborn, and they hate you on sight. Because you just killed them. So it's ineffective to kill people. Whereas it's nice to save their lives and prolong them. Then they like you, and they're friendly, and you broaden your friendship with people, which is what makes life worthwhile, is having friends, and liking people, and having them like you. Otherwise, it's horrible. Life is terrible if you just have everyone as your enemy. And if you become a killer, you end up with everybody being your enemy. Killers always kill each other eventually. You know? So I prefer to translate, instead of right and wrong, realistic and unrealistic. So a realistic worldview, you know, realistic intention or motivation, realistic speech. Those three things, I think, really epitomize what the Buddhist media should be. Realistic worldview now means to help people gain an understanding of a realistic understanding of causality. This is another thing that surprises people when they're thinking of Buddhism as a religion, that Buddha was celebrated in India. The most important celebratory verse, Theravada, Mahayana, doesn't make a difference, of the Buddha is Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetun tesham tathagata hiyavadat tesham chayo nirodo evamvadi mahasramaniye swaha. Isn't that nice? But what that means is, it came out in the biography where a disciple of the Buddha was walking, one of his early disciples, in the bazaar begging his morning lunch. And some seeker yogis met him, and they liked his aura. And they thought there was something special about him. So they were interested in who his teacher was. So they said, who's your teacher and what does he teach? And he said, well, you go see him. He's in the grove outside of town over this way, that way. And they said, yeah, but you're a student and we like your looks. You look wonderful, darling, they said. So we like your looks. So what does he teach? You should be able to tell us something. So after much prodding, he finally said, Om ye dharma hetu prabhava, and so on. Which means, what my teacher teaches is that all things arise from causes. He says, he teaches what those causes are, and he teaches how to interfere with them. You know, how to intervene with them, that is, if they're causing something bad. That is the philosophy of my teacher, who is a great ascetic, a great wanderer, actually, not necessarily ascetic. So that's what he said. So Buddha is celebrated as the discoverer of causation, actually. And why is discovery of causation important? Because before that, in India, people thought the gods caused everything. So when something happened to you, you were sick, you would go and ask a priest to do this ritual or that ritual to save you because you felt helpless otherwise because the gods were afflicting you. Whereas when you discover causation, you discovered you've been eating the wrong food. You've been eating like genetically mutated food sent from Iowa by Monsanto. You've been eating some poisoned fish polluted by industry. You've been eating some injected beef poisoned by industry and so on, by industrial farmers. And so those are looking for the causes rather than thinking the gods did it. So that gives you power over your situation to understand the causation of things. And that was Buddha's discovery, really, a scientific, in a way, more than a religious discovery. And that is how he was celebrated. So a realistic acceptance of causality. Now we say, well, we accept causality. We are like a rational people. But do we now? We are in those of us who are secularists, for example, we follow the teaching of Richard Dawkins, the prophet Richard Dawkins, or Sam Harris, you know, the God delusion. And of course, I like what these people say, criticizing the religious fanatics. But they also are fanatics, and they tell us with great certainty and great authority that we have no soul, that when we're dead, that's it. It's all over. That our mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain. And therefore, we're not really here. We are essentially nothing. And our lives are meaningless and purposeless. And the world is meaningless and purposeless. It's a random accident. It's a mutation that happened in Mr. Darwin's beard. Rather than anything else. Okay? So what does that mean about causality? It means, okay, we have some little causality about our comfort. If our air conditioner doesn't work in the summer, we're gonna sweat. If this and that, you know, the car emissions, the Al Gore is gaining so much weight, the world is gonna sink. I'm sorry. And he's so fat, if he stepped in Amsterdam, it would sink a few centimeters. Which he should cut it out and go on a diet and run for president and save us from these monsters. But never mind, that's my own personal problem. So I'm saying that the supposed scientific authorities tell us that ultimately there really is no meaningful causality. There's some temporary ranges of it, and they can make an A-bomb or they can do this and that. And they promise all sorts of things they're going to find, but actually there's no meaningful causality. Your life is meaningless. My life is meaningless. When we die, if we were a wonderful person, we're in the same place as if we were a horrible person. Because we won't be existing. And that means actually, if you believe that, if you have that picture in your mind, if you believe the prophecy of Richard Dawkins, that means that right now you don't exist. Because if you really were in a bad state, just shoot yourself and you'll be nothing. But I'm sorry, from my work on the Tibetan Book of the Dead and from my work in Buddhism over years, I have a slogan for you. Nobody gets out of here a dead. You cannot escape the consequences of your causality by dying. Impossible. We will continue to reap the consequences of what we sow beyond this death. And if we behave like a monster, we'll be reborn in a monstrous way. If we behave like an angel, we'll be reborn in an angelic way. This profoundly affects how we are connected to causality here and how we are responsible to our actions and their consequences. And we no longer get into that typical American thing of like, what the heck? Go for it. What does it matter? You know, enjoy now, another tomorrow is another day. Live now or tomorrow you may die, this kind of thing. No, we don't do that. Because even you die tomorrow, if you have a bad diet in this life, you're going to be reborn with a sensitive stomach. And you're going to be unhappy. You know? So anyway, cause and effect. It's very powerful understanding to really make it thoroughgoing and to really be committed to it. It leads to, you see, this is what people don't know. They think, oh yeah, Buddhism, emptiness, voidness. I'm going to get into the void and then no one can bother me and ask me to wash the dishes. If I get into the void, if I did something wrong, they can't scold me because I'll be in the void. The void is no place, you know. Void is here. Remember, void is matter. Matter is void. Or they say form, but void is matter is what it really means. Void is matter. Matter is void. This is the void. You see, the void actually means there is no nothing. There's no way out of an interconnected network of life. You're infinitely involved in this network of life. And therefore, instead of feeling some sort of escapist thing of I can be apart from everything, every tiny thing you do has infinite consequence. And therefore, anything you do can be a little better or a little worse, and you become extremely mindful that it always be a little better. Because that little shift toward the better, you know, when you get mad, just a little, stay mad a little shorter time. Say a few less nasty things to your maddie. Say, be a little more self-restrained. And that has a huge effect in the future. You know, baby steps. Baby steps, as Bill Murray, the great Buddhist sage Bill Murray used to say. Baby steps. So first. Second, a positive outlook. One thing Buddhist media should communicate is a positive outlook on human potential, on the individual evolutionary opportunity that we have. And therefore should be critical and should show as critically theories that people have. You know how people say, oh, everybody's all the same. Oh, you know, Aunt Gertrude, you know, when she was little, she was a pain and she's still a pain. And when we have Christmas dinner, she still complains. And everybody, nobody changes. So-and-so went to some place and they worked with Mother Teresa when they came back and then they were cranky as ever. Nobody ever changes. You know those kind of theories. So-and-so meditated for 50 years and they're still cranky, grumpy, weirdo. We hear that, but that's not true. We change all the time. And if we don't pay attention, we get worse, actually. More grumpy, more cranky, more irritable, more annoying to our wives and husbands if we don't work at it. We have to guide our causality in the right direction. We have tremendous inertia toward bad habits and so forth. I mean, I'm not calling any kettle black. I'm among the worst. I'm an American, after all. So, a New Yorker. So media should be always critical of these theories that people don't change and realize people always change. And also realize that, you know, watching television is meditating. You know, watching a film is meditating. And therefore, we are invading people's meditational space when we make a film, when we do a show program, when we even talk to them. It's a therefore grave responsibility to talk to them. We should do something meaningful, something cheerful, something clear. Even if it's a tragedy, it should be a tragedy that opens their compassion. In Indian art, aesthetics, which is very connected with Buddhist theories of art, compassion is developed by tragedy. Tragedy creates the aesthetic mood of compassion. And it works on the energy of compassion by opening the mind to suffering and thereby making suffering more intolerable. And that's, of course, so it doesn't mean it all has to, all Buddhist media should be la, 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 la. It can be